during the period that I'm writing about him, he loses a child to SIDS. He almost dies because of malaria and meningitis. He almost dies in a car crash, and he gets ousted from the company he created. So the rest of his career, the career that's written about, is all after that.
Jimmy is an American author and former managing editor of the Huffington Post. The founders, the story of PayPal and the entrepreneurs who shaped Silicon Valley.
I found Elon Musk's college student government campaign platform. Perhaps the more surprising thing is that, unfortunately, a young Mr. Musk did not win his student government race. He lost.
But why you? Why do you think Jimmy got this role? Let's take a step back.
I probably wasn't the person to write the book, but I was the only person that was willing to email hundreds of people, talk to hundreds of people, log the miles to sit with them, really listen to their stories, and then stitch them together into this kind of book. Where I started was a friend of mine knew Peter Thiel. So my thought was, look, if I can get him on board, maybe he can make one or two introductions, and that's all I need. And then I'll get the rock rolling down the hill.
What do I mean when I refer to the PayPal mafia, per se?
The group of people who worked at PayPal from the years 1998 to 2002, who participated in the company's creation and who later went on to build companies like YouTube, LinkedIn, Yelp, Yammer, Palantir, SpaceX, Tesla, so on. I mean, they just sort of did everything in the world of tech. I would say the most famous members of that alumni group have gotten most of the attention. So that's Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, Peter Thiel, etc. They have an idea. The idea changes every day. They have to work very, very, very hard over a period of 4 years, and they are successful by the skin of their teeth. Don't spend so much time believing that your PowerPoint has to be perfect. PayPal is a classic example of a plan that had to change a lot in order to be successful.
Let's start with Peter Thiel.
Unbelievable identifier of talent.
Max Levchin.
Classic American immigrant story.
Elon Musk.
And so this is somebody with just sort of superhuman endurance.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, to Learn, Speak, Teach, powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. If you love to learn, be inspired, and succeed, we're here to speak and teach. I'm your host, Ben Albert. I believe if you're not living, you're dying. If you're not growing, you're withering. And if you're not engaged, you can turn this off right now. Because we here at LST are lifelong learners. And listen, I'm not your guru. I'm an ordinary guy on a journey to learn from the experts. My goal is to host each conversation with a beginner's mindset, learn, and let the experts speak and teach their truths. Join us! Oh yeah, and don't forget to subscribe. This episode is brought to you completely free. Get some stake in the game here. My fee for the show only takes a few moments. If you gain value from the episode, personally share with a friend and explain your favorite part. Bonus points. Please leave us a review on Apple, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you listen to the show. All right, let's get started. Welcome, everyone, once again to Learn, Speak, Teach on the Real Business Connections Network. I'm here today with Jimmy Soni. Jimmy, what's up, man? How are you?
Yeah, good to be here, man. I really appreciate you taking time to do this.
Dude, excited to have you. The shortest introduction is Jimmy is an American author and former managing editor of the Huffington Post. He is best known originally for A Mind at Play, his biography of Claude Shannon, and most recently, and specifically why I wanted to have him on, because I read the book and I loved it, The Founders, the story of PayPal and the entrepreneurs who shaped Silicon Valley. I read somewhere in the book that you had 15 days worth of audio in interviewing to prepare for this. So taking 15 days worth of audio and shrinking into a podcast is going to be impossible.
Right.
But I'm curious, give us like a big surprise. So we're talking the founders of PayPal. We're talking like the goats of entrepreneurship in a weird way.
any
not
big
in a weird, not in a weird way, in a totally accurate way. Actually,
it's I've never used the term goats of entrepreneurship. Right. It sounded funny when I was saying it. Any big surprises from writing this book?
You know, there are a ton baked in the book, but I will give you one that people really haven't like actually mentioned that much on Twitter or anything else, which is kind of funny. When this is totally, it's a little random, but it's a surprise to people. When I was doing the research for the book, one of the things that, to take a step back, like I'm writing about people like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman, but when they are younger, right? So they're like college, post-college, like what they did career-wise. So one of the things that I did actually is I went back and I looked at the student newspapers for the places where they went to school. So for Reid and for Peter, that was Stanford University. And for Elon, that was the Queen's University in Ontario and then the University of Pennsylvania. And so like what I would do is I would like open up the archives and like type in various combinations of things and see what I could find. You just like never know what you're going to stumble on, right? So I did this for the University of Pennsylvania where Elon went to school. And it took a while, and I noticed some misspellings, and I test a bunch of different words. And I can't tell you the number of times I was reading about like the Musk ox for like page after page after page or whatever, or Musk that was improperly like, you know, put into the system as music. And so I was reading a bunch of stuff about music. But I found Elon Musk's college student government campaign platform. And what's surprising, I think, is like, A, it's just a really interesting historical document at this point because he's a figure, you know, he's sort of a larger than life figure now. So it's interesting to think of somebody like him running for student government one day. Perhaps the more surprising thing is that, unfortunately, a young Mr. Musk did not win his student government race. He lost. And there was like it was kind of funny because there's a bunch of seats that are available. And like, you know, he's a pretty passionate person. But I guess the voters of the University of Pennsylvania, Wharton, did not want him to represent them on student government. Perhaps this is for the better, because then maybe this like shifted him into a life that was more, that he was more naturally suited to. But I think that's one of the big reveals in the book is that I found Reid Hoffman's student government platform and Peter Thiel's student government platform, and both of them won. And I put that next to Mr. Musk's. And it's just, I think it's a fun little aside, because I think it's also tempting. You know, it's like tempting when you're thinking about these people to think about them as the people they are today, ignoring the fact they had like a whole life before they got into entrepreneurship.
It's fascinating stuff. And the book was incredible. There's a million things I learned from the founders. I want to take a step back, because we'll get into, we're talking about these gentlemen are worth billions of dollars today. They did something right. How did you, I mean, you're a young guy, you're charismatic, you're a good writer, but why you? Why do you think Jimmy got this role? Let's take a step back as to what brought you into this role, being the author of the first real book on PayPal. What brought you there, and why do you think you're even qualified?
Yeah, the honest answer is like, I'm probably not qualified. Or I probably wasn't qualified. I mean, that's the truth. But yeah, but it's a very fair question. So the more natural person to write a book like this is probably like Kara Swisher, right? Who's like sort of famous in tech journalism, or maybe somebody like Walter Isaacson, who's like a seasoned, like he's done this, he did this for Steve Jobs, et cetera. But part of what happens in book world is like books are excruciatingly hard to do. And there are a lot of like ideas that of books that should be written, but just nobody wants to put pen to paper to do them. And nobody wants to do the interviewing. I had this idea, and my sort of operating philosophy was like, look, it's a great idea. Maybe I shouldn't be the person to do it, but I'm just going to kind of fake it until I make it. Or more specifically, I'm going to fake it until someone says no. So I was like, I can joke about it now because I'm not, you know, I was like, the book is done. It's out. It exists. It can't be undone. But I often had this feeling like when I was in the early stages of this project, which took about 6 years, I would say for the first 2 years, and my friends would like totally testify to this, I kept just waiting for someone to shut me down. Like I just kept waiting for the phone call or the email or the something that says, you know, Peter has changed his mind and he would much prefer that you not do this, you know, or like Elon refuses to meet with you and, you know, there'll be consequences if you pursue this project or whatever. But that never happened. Nobody ever said no.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, I can just keep going until someone says no. And what I would say is that once I got past that stage of it, where everyone that I wanted to talk to was willing to speak, and where I felt like the door was more open than I thought, it gave me the confidence to then say, okay, now that I know I can do this, I'm going to make it really exceptional. And in a way, like, not being the natural person to do it gave me a bit of a chip on my shoulder. Like, I was like, no, well, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it great. Like, it's going to be amazing. And so, but the shorter answer to your question is, I probably wasn't the person to write the book, but I was the only person that was willing to email hundreds of people, talk to hundreds of people, log the miles to sit with them, really listen to their stories, and then stitch them together into this kind of book. And I had done books in the past, so I knew what doing a book was. This was different because I'd never written about living subjects before. I'd always written about historical figures. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, it was like one of these funny situations where I might say to myself, like, I'm not the person who should be doing this book. But because I was not a day-to-day journalist writing for the Wall Street Journal or whatever, I was actually, like, in some ways a better person, because I could tell these people, look, I don't really care what you're doing today. Like, SpaceX, fine. You do your SpaceX. It's not of interest to me. What I'm interested in is what happened 20 years ago. And so that, it was like I got to enter the conversation with a little bit of a different, it was like a different air was in the room, right? Yeah. Because you could imagine that if you're Elon Musk, like, all day long, people are pestering you about Twitter or SpaceX, Tesla, whatever. And then somebody, like, walks into your house and he's like, yeah, it's cool, man. Like, all those things are cool. We're going to talk about 20 years ago. We're going to talk about the year 1999. It was just a different, it created a different vibe for the discussions. And so, you know, that's the irony. The irony is, I was probably not the person who should do this book, but in the end, I was probably the ideal person because I didn't particularly want to cover what was happening in 2022 or 2021.
Yeah, you're coming in with a different lens. You're allowing them to take a trip down memory lane. Sounds like you sent all the emails, all the phone calls, so I'm grit. Like, I can send emails and make phone calls. But what's the probability of me just going on Google, typing in Elon Musk's phone number, giving him a call, and suddenly going through old, you know, textbooks of photos and stuff like that? Like, the probability feels kind of low. What actually was your first move? Because I presume cold calling Elon Musk wasn't your first move.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, there were people, by the way, that I cold called where it paid huge dividends. Like, the cold email worked, but it wasn't for people who get a million emails a day. Where I started was, a friend of mine knew Peter Thiel. And I kind of had an instinct that, look, Peter was the CEO of the company when I went public. He has invested in many of the companies that have come out of the alumni group. He's a sucker for kind of crazy projects. Like, he's, like, always willing to entertain a meeting with somebody that has an idea. So my thought was, look, if I can get him on board, maybe he can make one or two introductions, and that's all I need. And then I'll get the rock rolling down the hill. And that's exactly what happened. I had my friend introduced us, my friend Ryan Holiday introduced us.
Oh, okay.
And he said, and Peter was, like, open to the idea. So then I prepared like crazy. And I basically said to him, look, there's this very specific period between 1998 and 2002 where you and a number of your friends come together to build this company called PayPal. Many of you have never done anything like this before. And in fact, most of you couldn't be more different from one another if you tried. But you're successful, and it seems like you learned a lot based on what I've read and heard. And I said, somebody needs to do the book about this. And I said, and it's not the book that you wrote, Zero to One. It's actually a different kind of book. It's a story. And he, like, laughed. He, at one point, he goes, you know, it's really funny that he sort of said, it's really funny, I'm paraphrasing, that you're saying this, because at one point in my life, I actually thought that I should write this book. Like, I should tell the PayPal story. Mm-hmm. And I thought about doing it with friends or whatever. And he said, but to be honest, like, there's just many other things that are occupying my time. I encourage you to do it. And I kind of had to say back, well, thank you. And I will need to interview you. And if you could, like, make one or two introductions, that'd be great. Then what I did is I was able to get that. I was able to get him to talk to me, and he was willing to make introductions. I did not ask him for too many introductions. What I would do is I would, like, go to the next person and I would say, hey, could you, like, make one or two introductions? And on and on and on. It kind of mushroomed from there. And at one point, when I knew it was the right time and I had done enough homework to talk to Elon, there was somebody that I had interviewed who had worked closely with Elon in a different context. And I asked that person, like, hey, do you think Elon would be willing to talk to me about this? And this person said, let me just ask him, like, we're going to dinner in a few weeks, I'll get back to you. And that person asked Elon, like, hey, this guy, Jimmy, like, kind of a nerdy guy. He's like written this book about Claude Shannon. He's working on a book about PayPal. And I think you should talk to him. And that night he introduced me to Elon. I replied. And that's where the ball got rolling on that one. But every one of the people that I talked to, especially the higher profile people, you're right. You can't just cold email. But I would actually argue, like, you'd be surprised at how far cold emails can get you if you're genuine, if the ask is specific, if you are respectful of people's time, if you're respectful of the fact that, honestly, like, inboxes are crowded. Like, I'll give you a little strategy I used. I often would only send emails to these particular kinds of people on the weekends. Why? It's just less crowded, like there's less, you know, noise in the system on a Saturday or a Sunday or a Friday night. The number of Friday night emails I sent, by the way, is pretty legendary, because I knew, I was like, look, these people get hit up just all day long for everything. And you don't want to be the person that's an annoyance. And so that's sort of the broader story about, like, how to go from warm intro to actual meeting. And then part of it was just making sure that I was judicious about respecting busy people's time.
I love this. And you did have great credentials. So I want to put an exclamation point on that. And another thing I want to put an exclamation point, you said Ryan Holiday, who many people probably know, he helped bridge that gap. So you had built a relationship with someone who was influential in making this possible well before it ever was possible. You were digging the well before it was thirsty, per se.
Yeah. And
gave you that opportunity.
I think that's right.
Please go. Do you have anything more?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's right. But it wasn't as though, you know, Ryan and I, like, connected over books and various marketing things. And I love his work on Stoicism. And it wasn't as though, like, I had some plan for the PayPal book. I just had the idea. And Ryan was the first and natural person for me to bring it to as an idea, cool. Not sort of strategically thinking, like, oh, he knows Peter. It was more like, Ryan is a good nose for books. And I said, hey, you know, there should really be, like, an origin story of PayPal. He responded favorably and then was like, hey, why don't I just, like, see if you can get a meeting with Peter? No guarantees. I'll, like, pitch the idea to him, but, you know, we'll go from there. And so it is the case that I think the point, one of the things it illustrates is a pretty powerful point, which is, in many cases, my view is, like, the role of peer groups is more powerful than mentors. So, like, if I were thinking about, like, 2023, like, if some young person were asking me for advice, I would say, listen, there's been all this writing for 50 years about the power of mentors. But as organizations become flatter, and as young people go into companies and have, like, bigger roles, and as startups become more part of economic life, I actually think, like, peer groups and, like, you know, relationships with people who are around your kind of age and experience probably outweigh the power of mentors. Not like you can't actually sort of quantify that necessarily, but I think that one of the things to remember is I didn't begin with a person who was older than me, who was in Silicon Valley with 30 years of experience. Right. I began with my friend Ryan, right, who was a fellow author, and it was a peer-to-peer relationship that launched the project.
What's your opinion for someone who's asking, well, how do I find the proper peer group? How did you find your proper peer group?
You know, Ryan wrote some really great stuff and I reached out to him by email. And I can tell you that this, like, let's take this morning as an example.
Sure.
I texted with my friend David Senra, who runs the Founders podcast. We met over Twitter. I texted with, he goes by a pseudonym, Liberty. He runs this amazing Substack newsletter. It was because I found a comment that Liberty made about one of my books and I reached out to him by email. My friend Chris Wilson, same sort of deal. We, like, connected through friends digitally. It is the case that, like, I don't think it's particularly hard to show appreciation for people's work, right? So, like, some of my best friendships now are people where I just saw something they did, I wrote them a note, and the note led to a coffee, and the coffee led to a friendship. I don't think that's, like, I'm not any kind of special person in that regard. I don't, you know, I live in Brooklyn, so maybe I live in a place that has a slightly higher concentration of writer types and other things. But a lot of the people that I just talked to don't live in the city that I live in, right? We have remote friendships. And I would say that it's easier than ever. I mean, for people who are, like, really struggling with that question about, like, how do you answer the peer group thing? Here, I'd offer two big, maybe counterintuitive pieces of advice. The first is, your peers don't have to be flesh and blood human beings. Like, you could think about it this way. Like, one of the things that like Charlie Munger talks about a lot is like how his he sees his peers as like old like writers and thinkers. Like he'll like talk about how like Ben Franklin is somebody who he like thinks of as a mentor, right? But Ben Franklin's not like alive to give him mentorship. So one thing is to remember that like you can turn people's writing, talks on YouTube, podcasts, books, etc., into a kind of peer that you would turn to for advice, right? You could sort of like ask yourself the question, like, what would they do? The other thing I would say is, like, I don't pay a big price if I see something online and I send someone a note that says, I thought this was great, right?
Right.
And I'm not expecting anything out of that. I'm not trying to be friends with them. But odds are, if something that they wrote struck me, then maybe we have some way that we could work together, help each other out, et cetera. It's more that, like, I think that a level of openness is what matters, not necessarily like, oh my God, blah, blah, blah. The final thing I'll say is it does help to try to choose peers and friends who are the kinds of people that you aspire to be, right? So like, and it doesn't have to be like around like work stuff. It can be just like, maybe you just meet somebody and they're like a ridiculously kind person. You're like, man, I really need to be nicer. And they're the kind of person that embodies that. I would say like aspirationally choosing friends is a good thing. Like a lot, like the funny thing about my life today, I and my friends will say, it's like, I aspire to be like my friends, you know, like it's like almost like this thing. If I look at them, I'm like, man, like if only I were as, you know, blank as blank. So hopefully something in there is useful for people.
I think all of it is useful, Jimmy. I'd add two small things from my own personal experience. People ask me all the time, like, Ben, how do you get such fascinating people on the podcast? And it's every time it's just a two-part journey. It's I've consumed their content, so I've already vetted that I want to learn more from them. And two, I make the ask. It's really the two-part journey. And the one piece of advice for anybody, and I've said it a million times, but I'll bring it up again, is every time I listen to a podcast, watch a YouTube, it almost doesn't even matter. It used to just be podcasting. Now it's anytime I consume content, I reach out to the host. I reach out to the guest on YouTube. I reach out to the creator, even if it's just like an Instagram reel that like, if I liked it, I'll take 10 seconds to send them a DM and tell them why I liked it. And if you're listening to the show right now as an example, and you took any notes, you already have the DM ready. You just say, hey, I wrote down this quote. Thanks for doing the show. And that's really all it is. I send those messages and the people that respond, I start a conversation with. The people that don't respond, I still put a piece of goodwill into their life to let them know that, you know, what you're doing is kicking ass and I appreciated it. And then the people that respond are usually really open-minded to start a conversation. It surprises me sometimes. Is that your experience as well?
100%. And I would say even the people that don't respond the way you would like can be instructive. They can teach you something. You know, you can kind of like think about something that they wrote to you. I had this experience recently. This is funny. I haven't talked about this too much, but you know, I wrote to somebody who was a tech luminary because I was interested in something that he did when he was in his 20s. And I wrote to him and I said, hey, listen, I think there should be a great book about like this particular company and you're the person who founded it. I figured I'd reach out to you. And, you know, I'm sort of like, I'm coming off of this successful book, The Founders. I've done some other things. Like I was like, okay, shot on goal, 50-50. And he writes back to me. He said, Jimmy, I, you know, thank you for reaching out. Appreciate the kind words. I'm like familiar with your work. Really love it. And he said, but I spend my time thinking about the future, not the past. So I'm going to have to politely decline. Right. And I wrote back to him. I said, hey, thanks so much. I appreciate the response. And if you change your mind, I'm here. And I don't know what it was about the way he wrote it, but I kept thinking about that thing that he wrote to me. Like, I think I spend more time thinking about the future than about the past.
Yeah.
And it just ricocheted in my head. Right. So like, it was a fun thing to think about. Like, what would it be like to be somebody that's like not writing history, but sort of imagining a future? And I remember thinking like, how great is it that like his rejection, like left me with that thought for a couple of days. And if that's the worst thing that, like, if that's the worst thing that happens, then that was an awesome shot on goal. Right. Cause like, actually it was a good trade of an attempt for something that made me think. I'm with you all the way on. I don't think there's a downside to this. And the other thing is it makes you, you know, creators have this funny thing of like, you put stuff into the world, you know this, and you never hear from people. It's actually surprising how few people reach out. And I will tell you, readers of my work have become friends just because they reached out. And it still astonishes me, by the way, like how few people will just drop a note. This does not take long. In the era of email, it costs you no money, and more people should do it.
Where did you learn this kind of stuff from? Were you just always an insatiably curious person? Did you have a mentor come in and give you some of these strategies? Like, you have a great combination of curiosity and grit. Like, you're a hard worker, but you seem insatiably curious. Were you like that as a child, or was it learned? I know that's a deep question, but what are your thoughts?
This is becoming therapy, so gotta, you know. No, I think, look, there's a certain amount of it that I'm sure is just sort of native born curiosity. Yeah. I was always like had my nose in books, always like was reading when I was a kid, trying to understand origin stories. I think if I really had to kind of give a precise answer, one key thing is I'm always interested in how people who are successful become successful. I really, for example, like when I'm reading biographies, I'm most interested in the years, like let's say 15 to 40, right? Where people make pivotal decisions about the things that shape their lives professionally. So this is true, like in any area of biography, I'm like always fascinated by like, maybe let's say like chapters like 2 and 3, you know, like the kind of the early years.
Yeah.
So that naturally kind of lent me to moved me in the direction of just like, hey, like I could get that information from other people and then tell stories about what happened. But I would say part of it too is like my parents were immigrants who didn't know anybody, or didn't know English really. I mean, they knew English, but not super well. And so if I was going to have any kind of professional network, if I was going to expose myself to different kinds of people, different industries, different places, it was all going to kind of be on me. Like it wasn't like dad's friend was a CEO or like mom's college roommate was a such and such. It was kind of like, okay, I've got to go find these people for myself. And so I found that like when I was in college and then right after, I just got into the habit of sending notes to people to talk to them. Like I was at McKinsey for a couple of years, the management consultancy. And the only, like, it's like one of the only things I took away from there was I just like would cold email every person who ever worked at McKinsey and like jump on the phone with them just to be like, hey, so tell me, like, once you left McKinsey, what'd you do with your career, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a mix of inbuilt curiosity as well as just this idea that like if I was going to build any kind of social network or professional network, it was going to kind of be on my shoulders. And then I think, and you probably found this to be true too, people, because I'm producing books, because I'm creating something, like it's a consumable media object, yeah, you know, other people kind of are attracted to that. So it's not always me having to like pull people into my orbit. Sometimes it's just people want to talk and I'm always happy to listen or to talk.
Yeah, you're not just there to pick someone's brain. I don't like the term pick my brain specifically because I just don't like the analogy of having my brain picked. Right. I don't know if I can reproduce brain cells or not. You're not there just to pick people's brain. You actually have a tremendous amount of value to offer. I think that's an important point. You're skilled at what you do. You care about your craft. So you're offering value to the conversation rather than just picking someone's brain and not implementing the knowledge kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the picking brain thing can be dangerous, like especially these days where everybody's sort of way overscheduled. You have to be careful with those kinds of interactions. For picking the brain kind of discussions, if you're younger and listening, the best place to do that, I think, is conferences. So I'm not a big conference attendee, but one of the things that's nice about conferences is there's enough downtime and people have already blocked off time from work to be there. And so what happens is like in a setting like that, you actually have the chance to pick people's brain, but they don't have to schedule it in between like an important work meeting or like an important work thing. And so that's where I think you get the highest ROI on brain picking. And the truth is like anybody can get into any conference they want anytime. I mean, like it's like that's the honest truth. And to be clear, when I was interacting with the people that I interviewed for the PayPal book for the founders, I wasn't there to pick that. I was like brain picking with a purpose. I was writing a book, right? We all knew what the transaction was there. I would say that for more informal things like that, you really want to try to be in person just because, like, especially today, given that like Zoom calls are work, you know, and people are busy, it feels like an imposition to ask somebody just for general advice. It is, you know, I still do it. I'll still like if younger authors reach out, I still do it. But I would say that it becomes more of a it becomes a bigger ask, right? It becomes a bigger ask on my time and on other people's time.
It's interesting. That's good feedback. It's true. The work and the leisure have been blended so much that quite possibly the best time to get 5 minutes with someone's when you're in front of them at a conference. I've seen this. I've never done this, but a lot of people allow you to book 15 to 30 minutes with them while they're there. And I could probably just say, hey, Jimmy, I'd love to book 30 minutes with you. I don't know how to do it, if you have a way to book that time. And then Jimmy might just be like, oh, I got time right now.
Yeah.
And now the conversation started.
And I would say too, like it's not, I don't want to give a false picture of this. I will, yeah. Especially for people who are like kind of getting started maybe 10 years before where I was, I'll almost always either reply with something or make the time to talk to them,
yes,
because it's just important. It's like people do that for you. You've got to pay it forward. It's kind of how the whole world turns, right? But for super busy people, you will rarely get a response if it's just, I want to pick your brain. Like, there's just too much going on, right, in the world for them to worry about that. But if you're at a place where they're already going to be and there's a fair amount of downtime, it's a decent shot on goal.
Love it. Love it. So looping back to PayPal, I wish we could cover the whole book. I recommend people read it. It is in the show notes as well. Draft material for this project totaled several hundred thousand words. Wow, I don't even know where to start. Let's start with the meme, love it or hate it, but the PayPal Mafia. So to give a little bit of context, what do I mean when I refer to the PayPal Mafia per se?
Yeah, it's a well-known meme at this point in particular. It's the group of people, I mean, look, there's sort of the technical definition and then the kind of media-friendly definition. The technical definition is, in some ways, the group of people who worked at PayPal from the years 1998 to 2002, who participated in the company's creation and who later went on to build companies like YouTube, LinkedIn, Yelp, Yammer, Palantir, SpaceX, Tesla, so on. I mean, they just sort of did everything in the world of tech, right? You can usually take any modern tech company and find a connection to this group of people. And that's the alumni of this company, PayPal. The way it's been, like, you know, I would say the most famous members of that alumni group have gotten most of the attention. So that's Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, Peter Thiel, et cetera. And there's some like debates about whether the term is good or not, because like I had this board member say to me, you know, calling us a mafia is an insult to mafias. A mafia is far better organized than we were. And so it's like, okay, that's funny. But I think the more important thing is, in a way, the mafia piece of it describes everything that came after PayPal, like all the companies I just said. And really what I wanted to understand was the kind of VH1 behind the music, like what happened before you all kind of became successful, right? Like what was the uncertainty like? And so that's kind of where my focus was like, okay, at one point in your lives, you were all like not who you are today. Let's like go back and rebuild. Like what happened?
Yeah. And it's, wow. So 1998 to 2002, it's actually not that long, but a lot happened. To avoid trying to rehash the entire book, we'll broad stroke. It's 1998, maybe X.com, PayPal. Does that stuff exist yet? It's 1998. What's happening at that time?
Yeah. And I think the other thing is, I like treating the book as a broad stroke point of discussion. Like it's like people can go read the book if they want to learn about the book, right? And but what I would say is, like, if someone listening is saying to themselves, like, why should this story matter to me, right? I think the reason that it matters is because it's important to remember that the business titans of today weren't always titans, right? That at some point they got started somewhere, right? That the people who took their first job out of college and went to a company called PayPal, like, that was the start, and it was very unglamorous. And so you sort of start to see, like, how does a business career evolve from the roots up when someone doesn't know what they're joining, or they join this company and it's got a name, you know, and whatever. And so to my mind, like, the thing that's happening in 1998 is the internet boom, right? So it's this incredible period where internet companies, .coms are being created left and right. And you have a group of engineers led by this guy, Max Levchin, who move out west. They start to find people, they start to network, they start to meet people. Max Levchin meets this guy named Peter Thiel, and they start a company. Originally, the company's called FieldLink, then it's called Confinity, then it becomes known as PayPal. Just a few blocks away, there's this other person named Elon Musk. He has just finished his first big .com success, a company called Zip2. And he's figuring out what comes next. So he creates and has this idea for this financial services firm. He calls it X.com and he buys the URL X.com. And so kind of 1998 in his life is a transitional period. He is figuring out what is going to happen after I'm done with this earlier.com and how am I going to make this second thing a success? And so that's kind of where we meet our main characters is in this period of transition for, you know, that where these two people have met and they're figuring out their company. And this guy, Elon, has just finished up a company and is starting another one.
Before we kind of unravel the story a little bit more, totally unrelated question. What is Elon's fascination with X's? He has a fascination with the X, does he not?
Yeah, no, it's totally true. And he and I actually talked about this. And I wrote about it. I found the people who owned the URL before he did. And I got their history of it. And I was able to put that in the book. And then I talked to him about, like, what's the thing with the X? And then I actually went back and interviewed his coworkers. And it turns out it's not just some random, like, it's not as random as people think. For one thing is he just thought it was, like, he literally called, he said to me, and he said it at the time, like, he thinks of it as the coolest URL on the internet. He thinks X.com is the coolest URL on the internet. He owns it today. He repurchased it from PayPal, sort of purely for nostalgia or nostalgia's sake. He might do something with it. We don't know. The words, you know, the word is that he might, and we'll see if it happens. But there are a few concrete reasons he loved it. One, if you're on a phone and you type in X.com, that is much faster than typing in bankofamerica.com. And right. He could see in 1999 and 2000, like, look, at some point, the world's going to be overrun with these tiny little devices and people are going to have to type stuff into tiny little keyboards. And it's super annoying to type in like a bunch of letters. The second thing is that X in mathematics is a variable, right? It can stand for anything. And in his conception of his company, he wanted X.com to do standard banking, like checking and savings accounts. He wanted it to do brokerage. He wanted to do insurance, mortgage, lines of credit, anything financial he wanted to be able to do in one place. And so the idea was, like, you would have, like, you know, I don't know, payments X and checking X or X checking or X banking or X finance or X whatever. So you could have a flexible platform that was, like, pretty kind of wide, right? And then the other piece of it is, he wanted something memorable. So the idea was, okay, like X is actually, it sticks in the mind, right? And you could sort of remember it very quickly. And there was something about that was very appealing. I think that there were also at the time only three single letter URLs available. There was X.com, Y.com, and Z.com. And the one that seemed most appealing was X.com. And so that's the reason, among other reasons, that's why the company was called what it was called.
I'm smiling because it's such a fruitful answer to such a basic, silly question, but it makes perfect sense. So Levchin and Thiel are over here building a company that's going to become PayPal. Elon's building X.com. What are these companies doing and why did they merge?
Yeah, it's an unbelievable story, right? It's sort of one of the hearts of this whole project is that you have these two groups that are creating two separate companies, and then they become one company in the year 2000. And part of what happens is that they both start to do payment services. So the way most of your listeners probably know PayPal is, like, they use PayPal or they use Venmo, which is owned by PayPal. And it's person-to-person payments. If I wanted to pay Ben $5, I could email you $5, right? And that is not a super complicated function to create. So the Peter and Max, they have this company, Kidfinity. They create a service that does that. A couple blocks down the road, you have this guy, Elon, X.com. And he's like, oh, yeah, well, naturally, person-to-person payments is going to be a part of what we do. So they build it. They both start to take off at the same time on a platform that was in its early years then. The platform was called eBay. And eBay was an auction platform, still is an auction platform. And both of these payment services filled a very important hole in eBay's system, which is eBay hadn't quite figured out how to do payments. And so they both start to, like, rapidly take off. They're giving away money to take off. So what happens is, like, if I signed you up for PayPal, I would get $10. You would get $10. Like, it was a bonanza of freebies, right? So both of these services take off at the same time. They are competing viciously against one another. And, like, truly, it was like an intense competition. Even today, these people got pretty intense describing it to me. And eventually they realized, like, look, we're both going to die, or we could join forces and we could survive and be the biggest player in the space. And they end up choosing option two. It's a pretty fraught merger. It's not, you know, this is a lot of firepower in one room, but the two companies merge and become one. And that actually gives rise to the PayPal that we know and love today.
It's fascinating. You made an interesting point that they're giving money away. They're expanding. Both companies are exploding in popularity. But there weren't like fees back then involved. So what is the purpose of bringing in all these users exploding in popularity, but actually losing money with every additional user? Why would you take that loss? That seems like a crazy concept to bring in 100,000 people and I'm losing money on every person. It seems kind of bonkers to me at first glance.
Yeah, look, it sounded bonkers to some of the people who were around back then too. But remember, this was like the frothy internet years, 1998 and 1999 before the crash. David, it's funny, David Sachs made a joke that basically like addresses what you were saying. He said, you know, back then it wasn't thought of as crazy. Back then, here's how we thought about it. I'm paraphrasing, but this is not too far from the actual quote. And he delivered it in jest, but only slightly in jest. He was saying, you know, banks, maybe like they'll give you some, like they'll get like banks, a lifetime value of a customer for a bank might be like, I don't know, whatever it is. Like, let's say it's $100, right? And they might give you a $20 toaster to bring you in. So you've made $80 in that transaction because your lifetime value is $80. You spent 20 for the toaster. Your lifetime value is 100. You spent 20 for the toaster. You made $80. He goes, we were sort of thinking about it the same way. Like if we give away $20, but our lifetime value is like 150, then we didn't give away $20. We actually made $130. Like, it's going to be awesome. And so that was how they were thinking about it, was we just got to get to scale and then we can figure out the economics later. Now, to this team's enormous credit, they do. They do figure it out. They figure out the math later. But at the time, one of the people who was a part of the company, he was describing to me, said this was the biggest transfer of venture capital money to college students in human history, because it was just like people opening up fake accounts like Elvis.Presley, you know, whatever. And it was a big thing of people just skimming the freebies away.
Fascinating. They're figuring it out as they go. So these are young adults, straight out of college. A lot of the programmers and the team members are straight out of college. It wasn't this glamorous entrepreneurial brilliance per se on paper, I can't imagine. I think it's interesting, touch on like the culture of the company, because they didn't have a culture. It's not what you'd imagine. It's very odd and interesting, right?
Yeah. And I think the way to maybe the shortest explanation is they substituted hustle for experience, right? It is a classic Silicon Valley startup from that era. They have an idea. The idea changes every day. They have to work very, very, very hard over a period of 4 years, and they are successful by the skin of their teeth. And the reason it matters is what you said right when you stated the question, which is like, this is not some, like, they're not entrepreneurial luminaries, like, have a master plan and figure it out. A lot of the figuring out happened on the fly. This was very rapid problem solving. And it was sort of this series of like, you solve one problem and then there's another problem that comes like right on its heels. And then you solve that one and the next one comes just as quickly. So there's all these things that happen that you're kind of like, oh boy, you know, it's really just a series of like near disasters and fixing those near disasters. But at the end of that process, you have a company. And I, you know what I take from that? That gives me faith. And the reason is because these are some of the smartest people in technology today. But when they were getting started, it wasn't as though they had some roadmap, you know, that they're like, this was like, this is exactly how this is going to work. There's this great quote in the book that I found from Elon. This is delivered on some like interview that no one's watched, but you know, in a million years. But he says, when you start a company, when you do a startup, he sort of says something like, you're wrong, like your answer is wrong. And then what you do is like you course correct and you like do this process of what he calls recursive self-improvement to figure out the right answer. And that's like a very encouraging thing, because it means that if you're listening and your ideas are starting out wrong, you can get them to the place where they would be right. And it takes a certain amount of ingenuity, hustle, luck, perseverance, all the things. But it's sort of one of these like, don't spend so much time believing that your PowerPoint has to be perfect. PayPal is a classic example of a plan that had to change a lot in order to be successful.
Yeah, I can't just pick up a dart and hit the middle of the board every time. I need to learn and fail as I go. As a broad stroke, and I know you've touched on it, but it's a good way to kind of end this narrative. Why exactly, I know this is like the most difficult question, but why exactly do you think they succeeded when so many other startups fail? Was it the hustle? Was it the intelligence? Like, why did they succeed when everyone else seems to be failing?
Yeah, it's you know, it's kind of the question that animates the whole book. But if I'd like sort of distill it, it'd be a few things. One, they really did draw some of the most talented people in the world to work for them. Now, they couldn't have known that at the time, but it turned out that way, that so many of the people that worked there were just brilliant beyond brilliant, right? And I'm not even talking about the names that listeners know. I'm talking about all the people I interviewed that no one's ever heard of. The second thing is the pressure of the dot-com bubble bursting actually was very generative. What happened is because you couldn't raise venture capital money anymore, the company just had to like figure itself out and really figure it out in a very short amount of time, which led to all of this these creative breakthroughs that put the company on the right path. The third thing is they found a small success that became a bigger success. So earlier I referenced the place where these two companies were first successful, eBay. Once they cornered the eBay market and kind of figured out payments on eBay, it was a pretty natural step to like figure out what other places could they do that. So they expanded beyond eBay pretty quickly, but they had that, they took that first kernel of a success and then grew it into something else. The last thing I would say is their timing, you could call this timing, you could call it luck, you could call it divine intervention, whatever you want to call it, was impeccable. If they had waited, let's say 4 months, it's possible like eBay would have figured out its payments mess, right? If they had been 4 months too early, it's possible that like there wouldn't have been any kind of burning need on eBay, right? Or something like that. And so there was this way in which like the company arrived at exactly the right time for a company like this to arrive. And then it was, you know, and sort of that led to its success. The final kind of big piece of the puzzle is, I would say, I met very almost no slouches on this team. This was a group of people that for better, and I would say for better and worse, worked 7 days a week, all the time, trying to keep this company alive. And there are people who, you know, would praise that. I think there are some people who would criticize that, but it doesn't take away from the reality that I met a lot of people who pulled a lot of late nights to make PayPal successful. And it was inspiring. I mean, it's inspiring to listen to their war stories about, you know, winning by the skin of their teeth.
It is inspiring. You're inspiring. Thank you for bringing this story to the world. In a second, we're going to go to the rapid fire round. Before we do, how do I support you, whether it's reading the book, following your new endeavors? How do we learn more and stay in your world?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I would say, you know, top item on the list is if you've liked what you've heard, get the book and let me know what you think about it, right? The second way, I mean, I'm not super active on Twitter, but I am on Twitter and I'm there mostly just to connect with readers and like interesting people. And so drop me, I'm at Jimmy A. Soni. And you know, what I would say is like, if you like something in the book, because it's a big book, it's like, it's not short. If you like something in the book, post about it, like, let me know what you think or let other people know what you think. There's a lot of fun gems throughout. And so if you like something in it, post about it. That's probably the easiest way to help me. And then I'm also, you know, I do a lot of speaking. So if there's something that I've said or that's in the book that you want to hear more about, like I love to speak to organizations, institutions. So just reach out to me on Twitter or via email for that. It would be fun.
Love it. Yeah. If you guys are enjoying the book at any point, tweet it, share it, post a did you know. No, speaking of did you knows, usually the rapid fire round, they're shorter, sweeter questions, generally to get to know you better. If you're not opposed...
Not opposed, excited, not just not opposed, quite excited. I think it'd be fun.
If you're not opposed to not talking too much about Jimmy and talking just a little bit more about the PayPal team, I think it would be an interesting rapid fire round if I'll give you a name and just mention something interesting about them that people might not know. Does that sound like a fun
game?
Yeah,
that sounds good. Let's do it.
Let's start with Peter Thiel.
Something people might not know.
Or just anything that sticks out to you as a surprise, something interesting. It can be free association. There's no perfect answer.
Unbelievable identifier of talent. Like probably one of the best in the world, just given the range of people that I interviewed who said, you know, I never thought anyone would like take a chance on me, and Peter did. And they were some of the most talented people that I've ever encountered.
Wow. Max Levchin.
There's so many interesting things I could say about him. I mean, just because of the amount of time I spent studying his life. But classic American immigrant story, and shows you that, like, for all, like, shows you what this country can do that's possible nowhere else, just in how far he was able to go in his career in such a short time.
Fascinating. I'm going to like want to read the book a second time. There's so much in there. Elon Musk. Other than the X thing.
Fascinating. Let's do this. Like during the period that I'm writing about him,
yeah,
he loses a child to SIDS. He almost dies because of malaria and meningitis. He almost dies in a car crash, and he gets ousted from the company he created. So this is somebody who has and the rest of his career, the career that's written about, is all after that. And so this is somebody with just sort of superhuman endurance.
Superhuman. We'll do a couple more if you're up for it.
Sure.
We'll do David Sacks.
Arguably the person that deserves more credit for the success of the company than anyone else, because what he did that very few other people could do is force the company to pay attention to its users, not to what they thought great technology was, but what he knew users were actually doing, and then to kind of build and work and improve the product around them. And I heard from multiple people who said, you know, if it wasn't for David, and then there would be a second sentence that like was a big part of the success of the company.
Last one, we'll do a wild card and bring up one of the unsung ladies, because there's a lot like the picture of the PayPal mafia, and there's very much like a masculine energy behind all that. There was a lot of people that were pivotal. What are one of the ladies you want to mention today?
Oh man, again, I could do like another hour just on these people, but I would say, let me give you an example. Julie Anderson is extraordinary, like really just a crazy brilliant person. One of her biggest insights is one of the things that rescues the company. She figured out that it was more efficient and more effective for the company to build its customer service operation in Omaha, Nebraska. And she had family there, had like kind of ties there. And she builds, like literally, I mean, builds from scratch, like hires the first group of people, grows the operation. And customer service was a huge issue for PayPal until Julie Anderson fixed it.
She fixed it. Dude, I want to go forever. We'll do one more random question.
Sure.
About you. So you're going to write an autobiography. You've got three.
Oh God, no. I mean, I'll maybe someday, but I'm too boring. Writers, they're too boring for that sort of thing.
All right, we won't do the autobiography. So you're going to write a legacy piece similar to this one. And so you're going to invite a handful of people just to have dinner with. You haven't chose who you're going to write about yet, but who do you want at that dinner table? So you can kind of pick their brain per se, learn more and make that decision. Who would you just, your dream topics or people, if anything comes to mind?
I'm trying to think, you know, I would say, oh boy, I'll throw out a couple names. I think that Michael Lewis as a writer is somebody that I really admire, just like the way he has written, the topics he's chosen, how he lives his life. So he's high on the list. There's a swimmer named Diana Nyad or Diane Nyad. I just like think her story is amazing, and not a lot of people know about her necessarily, but I think she deserves a kind of wider audience. It's like she's somebody I find fascinating for endurance reasons. I would say that those are two. And then with the third, you know, boy, there's so many good ones. I'm not totally sure what I would do. I'm like looking over at my bookshelf just to see. You know, my sense is that like there's a lot happening in nuclear fusion, and there's a couple of startups within nuclear fusion that I find like the scale of their possible achievement is so big. I'd want to talk to somebody in that space. So I don't have a name yet, but that's like something I'm super interested in. Those three would be my list.
Jimmy, this is, in terms of depth, this is one of the best episodes, man. I had fun with you, full of stories, ideas, actionable insights. To anybody who's listening, we already talked about it. Whether you're resharing this, DMing either of us, consuming the book, take action from something you learned today. The full title, The Founders, The Story of PayPal and the Entrepreneurs Who Shaped Silicon Valley, check that out in the show notes. And did we miss anything? We covered a lot of ground, my friend.
No, I think we covered a ton of ground. I look forward to doing this again soon enough because this was a ton of fun.
Yeah, I just noticed I asked, did we miss anything? Oh my God, we missed a lot, but we'll do this again because there's so much to talk about.
That sounds great.
Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again for listening to Learn, Speak, Teach, powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. You need to go subscribe if you haven't yet. This show is completely free. If you gain value from the episode, personally share with a friend and explain your favorite part. Leave us a review on Apple, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you listen to the show. All right. Thanks once more for listening to LST. I am so grateful. Talk to you soon.
Of all the podcast hosts that I have talked to, Ben asks the questions you wouldn't expect, and it leads you to get the insights you won't believe.